Penguin Random House Audio presents Teaching White Supremacy, America's Democratic Ordeal and the Forging of Our National Identity by Donald Iacovone. Read for you by Carrie Height. For our teachers, but especially for Thomas J. Farnham, Edward W. Sloan III, and Leonard W. Levy. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught, from the 1949 musical South Pacific by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II. Introduction. When the teacher fails to meet the intellectual wants of a child, it is the case of asking for bread and receiving a stone. But when he fails to meet its moral wants, it is giving a serpent. Horace Mann, Thoughts, 1872. I learned firsthand the reality of Horace Mann's warning when I enrolled in a teacher training program in the 1970s. My college sent me to a high school in central Connecticut for my first classroom experience on the other side of the teacher's desk. Student teaching was to be the capstone experience of my undergraduate education. As it turned out, far more than I ever imagined. I will never forget the first time I entered the school teacher's lounge, a disheartening space with an awkward array of tired, empty seats placed against the four walls. The worn linoleum floor remained empty, except for a few teachers and an old wooden armchair strategically placed in the center of the room. In it sat an orating grandee, likely a department head, whose painfully white skin and frizzy bald skull were accentuated by his thick black-rimmed glasses. As I passed into the small chamber, I could not avoid him, nor could I ignore his gesturing arms or his sermon about the white man's burden. Then and there, I decided that high school teaching would not be in my future. But scholarship would, and I have spent most of my career studying abolitionism and 19th century African-American history. Several years ago, I began a study of the anti-slavery movement's legacy. I focused on the century after 1865 to understand how the collective or popular memory of the original freedom struggle helped create the modern civil rights movement. As part of this project, I wanted to measure how abolitionism had been presented in our nation's K-12 school textbooks. I naively imagined a quick look at a few volumes and then a speedy return to my primary research. Instead, I found myself overwhelmed by the collection of nearly 3,000 U.S. history textbooks, dating from about 1800 to the 1980s, at the Monroe C. Gutman Library at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. I stared at the shelves in shock, but it also proved inspiring. I immediately plunged in and resurfaced with a solid sense of what school books were like before 1865, so I could fully grasp the later history of the history I wished to understand. But in a clear inversion of Robert Frost's The Gift Outright, I was the collection's before the collection was mine. Within a short time, I found myself immersed in a study of how slavery, race, abolitionism, and the Civil War and Reconstruction have been taught in our nation's K-12 school books from about 1832 to the present. Hence, this book. One morning, as I examined a library cart bursting with about 50 elementary, grammar, and high school history textbooks, a bright red spine reached out to me through time and space. Why is this familiar? I wondered. As I opened the book's still crisp white pages, my gasp must have jolted those wonderful librarians working near me. It all came rushing back. Somehow, I had never forgotten the book's image of Eli Whitney, included not for his notorious cotton gin, but instead for inventing the concept of interchangeable parts, thus laying the groundwork for industrialization. Exploring the New World by O. Stuart Hamer, Dwight W. Follett, Benjamin F. Alschwede, and Herbert H. Gross, published and reprinted between 1953 and 1965, had been assigned in my fifth grade social studies class in Saratoga, California. Just like a legion of the early textbooks I had been reading, Exploring the New World never mentioned the anti-slavery movement. Slaves, on the other hand, proved necessary to pick cotton. Who else would do the work, the authors asked. This textbook, and nearly all the texts I reviewed, was not published by Southern Segregationist Press, and certainly not by the Klan or other far-right publishers, although such presses emerged with a vengeance in the 1920s and still operate, especially online. No. The thousands of textbooks that have stained the minds of generations of students, from the elementary grades to college, were produced almost entirely by Northern publishing houses situated mostly in New York, Boston, and Chicago, and by Northern-trained scholars and education specialists. Indeed, several of the most famous and influential American historians of the first half of the 20th century, nearly all trained at Northern colleges and universities, produced some of the most racist texts I had the displeasure to read. At the same time, however, my fifth grade textbook also stated that the people of the North did not believe that men and women should be bought and sold. Exploring the New World, published during the Cold War, followed the same pattern set at the close of the 19th century, seeking sectional reconciliation regarding issues related to slavery in the Civil War. Its authors also wished to avoid cultural strife and the reality of slavery and racism, and promoted national unity in the early 1960s by asserting that during the Civil War, everyone white was brave. Everyone white fought for principle, and General Robert E. Lee represented all that was noble, gallant, and heroic in American society. His name is now loved and respected in both North and South, they explained. We know that he was not only a gallant Southern hero, but a great American. What we have been teaching our children for nearly all American history suddenly became real and personal. The depth, breadth, and durability of American white supremacy and racial prejudice is certainly no revelation to modern historians and social analysts, black and white. To understand why it has proved so dominant, so irresistibly appealing, even essential, we must survey its development and range. No better place exists to trace that development and cultural importance than in the long history of the nation's textbooks. Embodying the values to be treasured by rising generations of Americans, textbook authors passed on ideas of white American identity from generation to generation. Writers crafted whiteness as a national inheritance, a way to preserve the social construction of American life and, ironically, its democratic institutions and values. Given the extent of the nation's belief in white supremacy, one would be astonished if it had not been a guiding principle of our textbooks. But this is not a book about a collection of bad books, nor is it an exposé of damaging educational theory. Instead, it is an exploration of the origins and development of the idea of white supremacy, how it has shaped our understanding of democratic society, and how generation after generation of Americans have learned to incorporate that vision into their very identity. Belief in white supremacy and black inferiority existed long before the creation of the American Republic, and along with a sincere but not contradictory belief in democratic republicanism, always has occupied the center of the American soul. James Baldwin, the celebrated African-American writer and critic, recalled in 1965 that, "I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history and that neither had I. I was a savage about whom the least said, the better, who had been saved by Europe and who had been brought to America." After school, he returned home and thought, "Of course that this was an act of God. You belonged where white people put you." And it always had been so. In the 1920s, for instance, if an African-American student had asked a teacher why no black people appeared in their history textbook, the answer would be that African-Americans had done nothing to merit inclusion. As the black scholar Charles H. Wesley reported in 1925, through textbooks and classroom instruction, the black student quickly realized that, His badge of color in America is a
sample complete. Ready to continue?